Our reading is taken from John chapter 14, reading from verses 25. That's John chapter 14, reading from verses 25, can be found on page 138. I have told you this whilst I am still with you. The Helper, the Holy Spirit, who the Father will send in my name, will teach you everything and make you remember all that I have told you. Peace is what I leave with you. It is my own peace that I give you. I do not give it as the world does. Do not be worried and upset. Do not be afraid. You heard me say to you, I am leaving, but I will come back to you. If you loved me, you would be glad that I am going to the Father, for he is greater than I. I have told you this now before it all happens, so that when it does happen, you will believe. I cannot talk with you much longer, because the ruler of this world is coming. He has no power over me, but the world must know that I love the Father. That is why I do everything he has commanded me. Come, let us go from this place. This is the word of the Lord.
In Psalm 62 and verse 1, we read, "My soul finds rest in God alone." My soul finds rest in God alone. We live in a noisy world. Actually, I was hoping as I began the sermon that an ambulance would go past or a motorbike or something. Actually, it's so nice and quiet. That always happens. You know that when we go about our daily lives, there's always noise, there's traffic, of course. If we go to parties or wedding receptions and things like this, they seem to have to play the music so loud that you can't have a conversation with each other. When we moved back to Birmingham, saw a nice house, the one we live in, we forgot that 14 years earlier we'd lived in Birmingham in the same area, because it's under the flight path. And so if we sit in the garden in the afternoon, every 3 minutes, everything is drowned out by the planes taking off from Birmingham Airport. When we go shopping, very often there's background music, or even, for goodness sake, if we kept waiting on the telephone, there's background music there as well. Someone has said that noise is the eighth deadly sin. And we Baptists are noisy Christians. Not as noisy as some, but we like things going on. We sing our hymns and we listen to readings and we say our prayers and we listen to sermons, for goodness sake. I'd like to read a short comment from Susan Hill. It's called "Silence, Please." The Bible is full of people gaining understanding, wisdom, and being given important messages when they go to silent places to pray or simply rest in the presence of God. Prophets and saints went up into the mountains and into the deserts, and Jesus felt the need to go away from the crowds that followed him and pressed in upon him to be alone to pray, to be refreshed and gather himself together again in silence and solitude. We call it charging our batteries. Well, now, Psalm 62. First of all, David is facing a difficult situation. He's been forsaken by those who he thought were his friends. He's being persecuted by them. The attacks come to him and they're filled with hatred and lies, he says, and they've made him vulnerable. And he's in danger of succumbing to the pressure. Could this be a description of when his son Absalom led a rebellion against him and he had to flee from Jerusalem. His mind must have been a jumble of emotions, anger, sorrow, a sense of betrayal. And yet, in the midst of all this, he tries to focus his thoughts on God. And as he does so, he experiences a feeling of rest and quietness. "My soul finds rest in God alone," he says. People seek rest and relaxation in all sorts of ways. But he says, most of all, we can find rest when we just concentrate on God and think about him and his love for us. And having experienced that quietness, that rest, he then emerges with a strong faith and he will tell others about it and share it with them. Well, in the first two verses, David sets out his theme in God, of resting in God. No doubt when the crisis arose, he searched and fretted for an answer. And that's perfectly natural. If we face a problem, then we cast around for some answer. Maybe a friend, a neighbour, maybe one of the services, an ambulance or whatever. He cast around for an answer to his situation. But then, having done that, he places himself in God's hands. And there he rested and found peace and found his faith again. Jesus promised his peace. That's why we read that passage from John's Gospel. And bear in mind that he said these words just before he was about to be betrayed and put to death. "Peace I leave with you," he said. "My peace I give to you. Not as the world gives do I give to you. Let not your hearts be troubled, and neither let them be afraid." And read again the account of Jesus' arrest and trial. He is there in this dangerous situation. He is confronted by the religious powers, the priests. He is confronted by the political powers of Rome. He is surrounded by hostile mobs and so on. And he stands there, as it were, like a giant. He doesn't say much, but he's the strongest person. The high priest, Pilate, and all the rest are weak compared with him because he has God's peace. He's been in the garden. He's told his father that he doesn't want to go to the cross, but "not my will," he says, "but yours be done." And then he rises up with that sense of peace and goes forward. C.H. Spurgeon, great Baptist preacher, said this: "Waiting in silence is a true expression of faith." Now, David not only finds peace, but he finds stability. If you look, he says that my salvation comes from God. "He alone is my rock and my salvation. He is my fortress, and I shall never be shaken." A rock to stand upon. He is able to stand in the middle of all this hostility, treachery, danger, all these things that surround him. And he feels secure because he is in a relationship with God. He knows the salvation of God in spite of his troubles. And because of his security, he claims that his relationship with God is like a fortress. I was watching a TV program the other day about the 20 most visited and sought after places in England, well, in Britain. And one of them was Edinburgh Castle. And when you see it perched up there on top of the rock, you just wonder how anybody could ever sort of attack it. The safest place, surely, in the country for the people to be. And David says, he's my fortress. He's like that. He will defend me. He's safe from the attack of his enemies. Well, then in verses 3 to 4, David describes the attitude of those who attack him because they think he's weak. He says, how long will you assault a man? Would all of you throw him down, this leaning wall, this tottering fence? I suppose we've all experienced that at some point. Looked at the garden fence and thought, you know, we're going to have to have a new one. It's only going to take a breath of wind to blow that down. And that's how they looked upon David. They saw him as being vulnerable, and they were going to attack him because of that. And David says that, David says, would you do that? Yes, they would. Yes, they would. This is just, in fact, the opposite to God's attitude to us all. From Isaiah, we read, a bruised reed he will not break, and a smouldering wick he will not quench. In other words, if we are a leaning wall or a tottering fence, and we've all been there, we're all like that, he doesn't write us off, he doesn't attack us, he doesn't knock us down. Rather, he supports, strengthens, and uses us. Evil's powers take advantage of weakness. God's power takes weakness and makes it strong. And then in verses 5 to 7, David repeats what he said before. Find rest, O my soul, in God alone. My hope comes from him. He alone is my rock and my salvation. He is my fortress. I shall not be shaken. He repeats it, but there is a difference between the two passages in that his faith is now stronger. I read an illustration about this earlier this week. It said that when a boat is at anchor, to some extent, it's at the mercy of the tide. The tide's coming in, the boat will float until the anchor holds it. And the opposite as the tide flows out and so on. And that's really an illustration of what David is saying in the first session. My salvation comes from God. He is my rock and my salvation. But now, he's like a boat that is tied up to the jetty that doesn't move. He says in effect that I shall never be shaken. In this section, he says, I shall not be shaken. In the first verses, he says, my rock, God is my rock. And here he says, God is my mighty rock. And notice the use of my in verse 7. He talks about my salvation, my honour, my refuge, and he's expressing his own personal faith. As Paul put it, I know whom I have believed, and am persuaded that he is able to do that which I've committed unto him against that day. I know that faith. And David has got that faith. Again, to quote C.H. Spurgeon, he says this, happy is the person who feels that all they have and all they want and all they expect are to be found in God. Now, in verse 8, we find a change. David has been talking about his own experience, the quietness, the rest, and then the strength. But now he turns to others. Trust in him at all times, O people. Pour out your hearts to him, for God is our refuge. Out of the quiet contemplation, of the greatness of God emerges a faith which David can't keep to himself. In Psalm 23, you remember the words, "My cup runs over." When we know the grace of God, really truly know it, our cup will run over. That's what David is saying here. That having discovered this peace and this rest in God, he's got to tell somebody about it. The fuel of evangelism is the realization of God's graciousness toward us. That's what makes us ambassadors for Christ. When we know the grace of God, when we can say, "He's done this for me." As with the now very popular hymn, of course, of John Newton, "Amazing Grace, how sweet the sound that saved a wretch like me. I once was lost, but now I'm found, was blind, but now I see." David says we need to trust God enough to express what we really feel. Then he says, "Pour out your hearts to him." I think it was last Sunday evening we were reminded of some of the horrible things that you can find in Psalms. There's some really strong emotions expressed there, and so on. But that's not a bad thing. We need to tell God what we feel. We need to be truthful with him. You see, in polite society, we don't always say what we think. But God is not polite society. God knows what we're feeling. He knows what we're thinking. And part of the peace of process towards peace with God is to be open with God and to say how we feel and to say what we're thinking and to feel him putting his arm around us and saying, "I know how you feel. I know what it's like. You know, let's look at it this way." We need to be open with God. The process of self-emptying paves the way for the peace of the soul, says David here. And then he turns in verses 9 and 10 to warn that the presence of God, the presence of God in our lives gives us a different set of values. And he talks about low-born men are but a breath and high-born are but a lie. And if we look at the world today, we see mob rule in many places. We see the crowd, and we know the danger of the crowd. Jesus experienced it, didn't he? When he rode into Jerusalem, it was a welcome to the Saviour, the one who was coming to be their Messiah. Within 3 days, it was crucified. And the rich, he says, the rich are high-born and they are a lie. The power of the rich may appear to be strong, but in the end, it adds up to nothing. David himself has been rich. David has known popularity. He's been swept to power as the king of Israel. But when he looks at it all, he says, what does it add up to? Popularity and wealth and so on. If I'm in God's hands, I'm in safe hands. I know stability and rest in God. And then finally in verses 11 to 12, it reads, "One thing God has spoken, two things I have heard, that you, O God, are strong and that you, O Lord, are loving." We celebrate the power of God. Some of you may have seen the interview with a British man who was on the team of planning and carrying out the placing of the first moon landing. And he said that he wasn't a believer in God. He was quite cynical until he saw the photograph of Earth from the moon. And that changed him. And suddenly it hit him that there was a creator. There was a creator. He was a great scientist. And these two things can come together. Science and religion are not necessarily opposed to one another. For as the scientist explores and finds new truth, new horizons, this can be a means of seeing God in a new way, even greater than we saw him before. When we think about God's creation and compare it with any other power we can think of, it makes us feel small and insignificant. And yet at the same time, says David, there's two sides to God. It's a bit like a coin. There's power, but there is also love or graciousness, and they go together. Power without love, in the end, can achieve nothing. And love without power cannot do it either. But the two together are in God's nature. Christians see Jesus as the one who has power over the forces of nature and over the forces of life and death, encapsulated in a human being whose love takes him to the cross to die for our sakes and for our sin. So David reflects upon his situation. It's still dire, it hasn't changed, but he's changed. In the midst of it all, he's found rest in God. Out of that rest, he's found strength. From that strength, he's had the courage to share the good news with others. And finally, he's discovered that this God of his, on the one hand, is mighty and powerful. On the other, is loving and gracious. And because of this revelation, David finds rest in God. And if we share his faith, we can find it too.